calling session number 11938, real 9.
Mr. G. Eyston, Rail 9. Will you go on with your account of the Battle of Arras, Mr. Eyston?
Well, I explained about the shell skidding along the road just in front of me. Two or three reasons or possibilities for this. One was it was just the trajectory of the shell. It landed on its side rather than on the point and past the detonator. There were rumours that the Czechs were producing good ammunition. And there was also a counter-rumour that the Germans had used this ammunition with the Czechs, somehow for their own advantage. So I think, really, that it was a trajectory. It landed on its side rather than on its point, and it didn't explode, it just skidded across the vehicle in front of me. The one behind certainly didn't, because that exploded. And I was told later on that one went underneath the vehicle, but whether that was right or not, I don't know.
Did you get the feeling from the bombardment, was it usual to have duds? Were there a lot of duds in amongst the shells?
Well, it was bad to tell, because sometimes if there were anti-tank guns, they used solid shot. Now, what this particular one was that was firing at me, I don't know, but sometimes, you know, if you want to see where ammunition's going, you put tracer in it, and you have sort of five or maybe eight, a solid shot and then a tracer or something like that. And it could be that they were doing the same sort of thing, they were using so much solid shot and so much HE, high explosive. So it was bad to tell, really, and this could, of course, have been the case with the shell that went in front of me. It could have been a solid shot. I don't think so, though. I think that was meant to be HE. It was meant to explode just in front of me, but it hit the road on the flat rather than on the point.
Was the artillery fire accurate at this stage? Was it dropping amongst the troops?
Yes. It was quite... But you see, when you go into artillery formation, you travel, I think it's 5 yards between each. Maybe I should go into this in a bit more detail. A section in artillery formation, or arrowhead formation, takes a section commander at the point, and then the rest go off about 5 yards to the side and about a yard behind. So that you've got an arrowhead of nine men with a section commander, and the rest are all going off at an angle. So they're quite well spaced out, really. In fact, if the artillery got heavier, it could be extended even further. But normally, I think it was about 5 yards that they went off at. So we didn't have a lot of casualties at this stage. There was a fair amount of fire, but not a terrific amount of casualties. There was some, but not a terrific amount.
Had your training prior to this prepared you for this kind of action, do you feel?
Oh, we've been trained for artillery formation. But not like later in the war, we had never been under fire. I mean, later in the war, they put you in bunkers and fired artillery over the top of you, and machine guns over the top of you. And in fact, in the very latter stage of the war, they put machine guns on fixed lines, and you had to crawl underneath it, which was... That was really naughty. Good, no doubt, good training. Very good training. But we'd had none of this. There was none of that at all.
So did you feel that as the action opened up and you were involved in it, that what you had been doing prior to this was helping you?
I think we were, as a battalion, we were coming to terms with the situation very, very well. We'd done all that was expected of us, as far as I could see, at this stage anyway. And, yes, I think we were doing very well. The tanks had done a terrific job. They'd scared the muck out of everybody, I think. And as I said many a time, that we didn't capture them, they just gave up the ghost. It never happened to them before. It was the first time it had happened to them. for all the battles that they'd done, it was the first time they'd ever really been attacked. They'd been stopped once or twice, but they'd never really been attacked. And in fact, Rommel said at one stage that he had to get on his hands and knees and press the men into action. They were so stuck and nothing was happening. They were just letting us roll through it, and he had to take over the reins himself and more or less whip the men into some sort of shape. And then, of course, he did get some tanks on the move, and he got his 88s on the go, which was a bit naughty for our lads. When you think that our lads had I think it was a 2-pounder, was the heaviest gun that we had. And our anti-tank guns were 1.5-pounders, you know. And then you come along with an 88 that'll fire for anti-aircraft or anti-tank or artillery. Different kettle of fish altogether. However, back to the battle. I was going up the road and going to the skyline. The best thing I could see was to get off the skyline and down in the valley a bit more among the troops. But having put my foot down to get away from the shelling, by the time I found a place to turn off the asphalt road and down onto a dirt road, I found myself away in front of the advancing company. So I went down the bank into the hollow, and then I saw this what looked like a railway embankment. And the shells were coming from that direction, so I thought, well, that's going to be a good place to get under. And I dashed down into the railway embankment and turned west to get back in among our own lads. I didn't want to be too far in front of our own lads. They might have mistaken me. So I turned west, or right and west, to go back behind this embankment. A terrific thing it was. You'd think it had been built for us. I thought it was a railway embankment at first, but apparently it's just the way the road had been built.
So it was a sunken road.
It was a sunken road. It was a sunken road. The side that we were on, I suppose the mound was about 2 feet deep. But on the other side, I would think it was possibly 8. It just looked like a railway embankment going away from the side.
Have you any recall as to approximately where you were at this point?
Well, I was somewhere between Borains and Agni at this point when I hit the sunken road. And I was turning towards Agni, because B Company had been helping in Agni, doing the mopping up his collecting the prisoners rather than and quelling any disturbances on the go. And I'm going along the road, and then the road veered off to the left or south a little bit. And as I got round the corner, I bowed into an artillery position, a German artillery position. And this was the first Germans that I'd seen face to face. It was only a small thing. It looked like a bit like a mountain gun, I should think. And there were two men sat behind the gun in the firing position, and about five, standing around it with the rifles over the shoulders and the bayonets on. Well, I drove in among them, jumped out of the truck and started waving my hands about and telling them to get up and away down the road, you see. And then I realised I was naked. My rifle's behind the seat in the truck. So I turned round, turned my back on them. I went to get my rifle. How stupid can you get? 7 Germans there, and I turned my back on them and walked back to collect my rifle. And I must admit they were shattered, more shattered than I was. But it struck me afterwards, these things. You say, how stupid can you get to turn your back on 7 Germans when you're on your own and your rifle's in the truck? Anyway, I eventually got hold of my rifle, and I made a point of ramming the bullet down the breech. I made sure that they saw what I was doing. And then I started pointing with the rifle muzzle, and they decided to get up and move then. So eventually I got them turned round, and by this time the infantry had passed me. the companies had passed me when I was on their right flank. So I finally got them marching down the road, and I've got one hand sort of holding the rifle. I don't know what would have happened if I'd fired it, because I'd probably broken my wrist and everything if I'd fired it. But I finally got them marching away, and then I've got to get the truck turned round. Now, I don't know if you can imagine trying to turn an 800-weight PU around in a narrow sunken road with one hand pointing at seven prisoners going down the road in front of you. Eventually, I did get the truck turned around and started going down. By this time, the infantry had come into the sunken road, and they were taking shelter, just like I intended doing.
Come just before you go past the prisoners, had you no thought that those five men with their rifles and bayonets might turn on you?
That's what struck me afterwards. After I turned my back on them and going for my rifle, I said, well, how stupid can you get? You know, turning your back on seven Germans already armed.
Did you take the weapons from them and put them on the truck?
No, I let them carry their weapons. I just followed them down. They were dejected, they were beat, they had no cares. They wanted to be taken prisoner.
How old were they, would you say?
I would say they were getting on, and I've often wondered about this. Certainly they had the grey caps on, but they seemed to have like a brown... It could have been a blanket they had wrapped around them, because they would be... Although they shouldn't have been cold then, unless it was shock. You know, shock can make you cold. Yeah, they could have been cold with shock, I should think. But they seemed to have a blanket wrapped around them as something...
You discovered what division or regiment?
No, I wasn't interested in them, quite honestly. It was the last thing in my mind was to take prisoners. I knew that if we came across, they had to be taken. And I've wondered about this many times, and I must have had some instruction on taking prisoners, because I had an idea of the Geneva Convention, and I wouldn't have known that unless I'd been told it. So I had some idea about taking prisoners. I knew that once they were prisoners, that they were protected unless they tried to run away. And if they tried to run away, they could be shot. Or they could be maimed. I didn't say you could be shot, they could be maimed. You had to aim and try and break a leg or something of this sort. It wasn't a matter of killing. It was if they were prisoners and they tried to run away, they had to be maimed. So I'd had some instructions, but I can't honestly remember it. But... I must have had, otherwise I wouldn't have known what was what.
What did you do with them now? You've got seven prisoners.
Well, now I've got seven prisoners, and I'm riding down, driving the truck with my rifle outside the door, and my right hand wrapped around the rifle, pointing it at the prisoners. And as I said, the infantry by this stage, they'd come into the sunken road for protection from the shelling, because it was a real good anti-shell barrier, you see. And... Well, I said, well, yeah, that's your lot. You get on with them and carry on. Because I was anxious to get hold of Major Jeffrey at this stage. I mean, I hadn't seen him since 11:30 in the morning, not to speak to. I'd seen him in the distance, but I hadn't seen him to speak to at all. And I've been missing two or three times already with wounded, taking wounded back to advanced headquarters. And... I was then following the company and the prisoners down the sunken road, and they were headed towards Borains, because about this time they'd been told that the attack in its sense was off, because the 8th Battalion hadn't caught up with us. The 8th Battalion had been held up before the start line, long before the start line. They'd been in trouble, and they'd had fighting almost from leaving their... starting line, not the start line, but where they'd forming up line. They'd had trouble. So there was a message through then that the attack was off, and Borains had to be taken and held as an anti-tank point. But the carriers before this... Oh, sorry, I'm a little bit... the attack on Henin-sur Scarth, is it?
Cougier.
Had just been started, because D Company had been drifted away to take over at Borain and do the mopping up there, and C Company and B Company were to get on and get on to Enin. when the carriers had already been dispatched to get all the tanks. It takes a lot of understanding today because there was no communication at all.
No wireless.
No wireless. Radio. In fact, the CO of the 7th Tank Regiment with the 8th Battalion, he was shot by a sniper while he was trying to semaphore his own tanks. Well, that'll just give you some idea of... The tanks couldn't communicate. We couldn't communicate with the tanks. So the carriers have been sent off to try and catch up with the tanks and sort of hold them on the Kojo rather than go on to the next objective till we got caught up. But as soon as this was set about, the message came from Div Commander that we were to sort of abandon the attack on Henin and get Borains and hold it as an anti-tank line and come down in front of the sunken road and all that as a complete anti-tank line. But the attack had started then, you see, so you can't just sort of stop and start, and once it started, they've got to go. You can't just stop them and start them. You can redirect a little bit, but you can't... In fact, redirecting an attack once it's started is a difficult thing. It's all very well to say you can do this, that and the other, but it takes a lot of turning around. If you, for instance, on the sunken road, if the sunken road itself hadn't gone to Borains, the companies would have gone straight on. If there'd been no embankment there, the companies would have gone straight on and headed for Henin. But D Company had already been detached to get Borains. Now, so far down the sunken road, there was another dirt road which crossed it, which went down to Henin. And as I got to this, Major Jeffries was through there with quite a few wounded, quite a lot of wounded. And I don't think we spoke very much. Yes, we did, because he told me to try and get the MO up. Major Heslop, I think it was. I think it was Major Heslop. I had to try and get him up with his blood wagon because there were so many wounded that we couldn't cope with them. I mean, at this stage, I was still the only thin-skinned vehicle on the go. And so I got another load in and went back to advanced headquarters, who by this time were in Achincourt. They were in Achincourt. And the blood wagon came round and dealt with quite a lot of people on the ground. I probably took some more back. I can't remember how many loads I took back, quite honestly.
Were these DLI men or tank men?
They were mainly DLI men, yes. Carrier men had suffered quite a bit, I think. And there were a few tank men. The 88s had really... they'd got caught by the 88s, yes, they'd suffered. But we were troubled so much with the 88s as the 8th Battalion. And we had the 4th Battalion tanks in front of us, and the 8th Battalion had the 7th Battalion tanks. And I don't think we were troubled so much with the 88s as the 8th Battalion had been. But there was casualties on all sides. In fact, I remember at night, later on the night, when the tanks started coming back and they were the tankies were jumping out and saying how they'd exploded in front of them and how the whole thing had shattered, you know. And they were explaining what a terrible time they'd had. But they'd done a good job, and quite a few came back and they went through the lines. I might be getting a bit ahead of myself now, I just can't remember. But I saw these people heading for Borains.
This would be D Company.
And the headquarters and the A Company had moved into Achincourt. And then the artillery really started on Borains and Achincourt. And just as that happened nicely, the Stukas came at the same time. I wouldn't have thought it was right that they used the Stukas and the artillery at the same time, but they did. And the first time you meet Stukas, it is frightening. It is scaring. They don't do so much damage, but the noise they make as they take the dive. They are artillery. They use them as artillery, and that's just what they are. If you hear a shell coming towards you, if you can hear the scream, you know it's gone. But the Stukas, you can hear the scream because they take the dive and they come down, it screams all the way down, and it releases the gun at about 200 feet or so. I can't just remember, but somewhere about 200 feet, it releases the bomb, and the bomb carries on in the line of the Stuka goes sharp up again. And it is really, really frightening. And I must admit that at this stage, I got in behind the sunken road at one stage, and I laid there, and I just wanted to pray. I admit it. I really wanted to pray. I'd been a choir boy till I was 13. We'd had church services all the time. Now, I'll not say I'd forgotten what the Lord's Prayer was, but I couldn't get it out.
In fact, you found yourself going back to a religious...
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Oh, I wanted to pray and make no doubt. I was frightened, and I wanted to pray.
Do you have any idea what was going on about you with other men that were in the vicinity? Were they in the same situation?
I don't know if there was anybody else praying, but yes, a lot of us were in behind this bank at this particular stage. Because we could see that it was our own lads that were getting bombed and dive bombed, because I knew the day company had moved into Ashingore. I knew the day company were in Borains. And just fortunate that I wasn't there as well, in a sense. If I had been wounded, I'd have probably been in the same place. Because I'd been following D Company all day, more or less.
So the main dive-bombing attacks were on Borains and Agincourt?
Borains and Agincourt, yeah. And the 8th Battalion suffered as well, very badly.
Any idea about what time of the day this would be?
I think it was about 8:15. Just as dusk was coming, I think. Just before dusk, I think it was. Now, I think that because the attack had been redirected to carry on to its first objective, that the prisoners were probably left with D Company who had gone to get to Borains. And from there, they were sent back to A Company, or there might even have been some from A Company going around to collect prisoners to take them back to Agincourt. But as both places were dive-bombed, it's bad to know just what did happen. And from Borains, they should have gone back, from Advanced Headquarters, they should have gone back to B Echelon, and then from B Echelon on to Brigade.
Any idea how many prisoners these would be? You probably wouldn't know at the time, but afterwards?
Well, I've heard various reports, and I would think it's something like 200. I've heard 200 mentioned on more than one occasion, but I've heard 400 and I've heard 600, but I would think that 200 is more or less what we're talking about, 200 prisoners.
And you're confident that they were moved or would be moving back?
They moved forward, I think, to Borains, because that was going to be the place that we were going to hold and keep. You know, we were going to put the anti-tank guns on if we ever got the anti-tank guns, which we didn't. That was the place that was going to be an anti-tank protected place. So they moved to Borains, and then I suppose that the arrangement was that A Company would come forward, because they were the reserve company, and take them back to wherever they had to go. But what happened from that, I have no idea at all. It's no good trying to conjecture, because I just have no idea. But I am almost certain that the prisoners would be in the middle of a dive bombing, whichever place it was, because both places were dive bombed and dive bombed heavily. So I'm almost convinced that that's where they would be. Unless some of them tried to run. I think I did mention before, when I was in ATAPS, that I was talking to a taxi driver, and he was there from the 1418 war. He'd run. He was an Englishman. And he'd run. He'd stayed there ever since. I suppose they must have known it. He was there, but he got away with it. He stayed in France and made a living in France.
So what's happened after the, or during, or when you next moved from the dive bombing attack, when you're lying in this sunken road?
Well, from there, as I said, I went back and I got the MO up. And by the time the dive bombing stopped, it was getting really dusk. Practically dark, anyway. Now, on the crossroads, the road between Washingcourt and
Bourains?
Between Ashingcourt and Bourains, yeah. That was a asphalt road, a good road between there. And then it's a peculiar situation because where you've got the crossroads of the sunken road, the ditches sort of went and the embankments went on the other. So you've got a level crossing. A level crossing of roads rather than a level crossing of railways. And of course, France is full of level crossings of railways as well, but there seems to be all level crossings in France. But it's a peculiar place, this, that the asphalt was a good asphalt road from Ashingcourt to Bourains. And then there was this road ran down from Tilloy. Anyway, from Tilloy towards Agny, which ran around by the sunken road. And there was a crossroads there, which there was a house on it, right on the crossroad, on the northwest side of the crossroads was the house. And battalion headquarters started to move into this, and the MO's truck was parked on the road south of the house. The house was on the northwest side, and the MO's truck was parked where I'd generally parked. That'd be my park. You know, I'd been in there a few times and then got off again, come back to it. So the MO's truck was parked there. In the meantime, Battalion HQ decided it was too hot for them there, and they moved back into Ashingcourt again on top of the railway embankment, sort of northeast of Ashingcourt. In Ashingcourt, but northeast of Ashingcourt, on the top of the railway. And when I got back, with the MO's truck being parked in my spot, I turned left onto this road heading north to Ashingcourt Railway and parked in the house on the same side of the road. And then I went off looking for Major Jeffries again, and he was away with talking to one of the company commanders. I never really caught with him there at all because we just nicely got settled down. And I did say the tanks were coming back and going along behind us towards Ashingcourt, and I thought they'd gone to Ashingcourt. But one of our tanks came back in a hell of a rush, and he did a prompt right angle turn on the crossroads and went north to Ashingcourt. Oh, I couldn't understand why, because all the others had gone on. But he was in a hell of a hurry, this one. And, I should think seconds, well, it might have been minutes, but it wasn't very long, before another tank rumbled up, with three more behind him. And he got to the crossroads and stopped, and put a shot into the Red Cross truck. That Red Cross is all around it, but in the dark, I suppose you can be excused for, you know. So that lit it up, lit the whole area up, you see. When that went up, it just lit the whole area up. Now, C and D companies by now, C and D companies, or what was left of them, had withdrawn from the front, and we were making a line on the north and south road, sort of the Ashingcourt to Agny road, either side of the crossroads. And behind us, we had, I don't know what, seven rungs in my mind, but certainly there are quite a few of the Daimler Stout cars belonging to the 4th RNFs, Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. And they were lined up sort of maybe 40, 50 yards apart, up behind, on the west side of the road. And we were sort of facing forward, looking we were looking to the east. And we had our sort of a firing position there, but I didn't have a firing position, but that's where we were. And I was trying to get hold of Peter Jeffries when this MO's truck went up. And he moved a little bit further into the middle of the road when he saw what was on, started breathing away with the machine gun. And then when the fire started going out, he just went down these RNF scout cars, one at a time, and lit the place up, kept the light going. He didn't go through them all at once. He just picked them off one at a time. And I was sort of laid there in the road with this thing because there was no way he could move because they were machine gunning as well as using their HE.
So how far was the tank from you, the nearest tank?
Oh, 200 yards. 200 to 300 yards. And my truck was on the other side of the crossroads, the wrong side of the crossroads. Now, I'd been told that Major Jeffries had gone among these tanks with hand grenades. So I thought to myself, well, if he's there, I'll just get down there and I'll get back to the CO and see if we can get the tanks back. Because I knew where the CO was, he was just off the railway. So I managed to go forward over the top of the hump on the road, of the sunken road. And I went forward maybe 50 yards or so, and then I crawled down and I got between the tanks.